The Secrets of Star Trek is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to The Secrets of Star Trek, where we discuss the hidden layers and deeper meanings found in all the Star Trek TV series, movies, and more. And today we're discussing the Deep Space Nine episode, If Wishes Were Horses. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel is Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
How's it going?
Very well, thanks. Jimmy is unavailable today, so it's just going to be the two of us. I want to encourage everyone to follow The Secrets of Star Trek in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, in your favorite podcast app, or watch us on YouTube, where you should also make sure to hit the bell to get notifications, and of course, subscribe at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. We do have some listener feedback at the end of the show, so stick around for that. And I want to tell you about another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you can find wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/mysterious. This week, we begin with Quark trying to persuade Odo to relax and have fun, but Odo says he doesn't have time for fantasies. Meanwhile, Bashir is distracted by thoughts of Jadzia Dax and his unrequited romantic feelings for her. And Miles O'Brien is reading a bedtime story to Molly. And strange things start to happen all over the station after the story is finished, starting with Rumpelstiltskin appearing in Molly's bedroom, and that causes chaos all over the station. Security alerts are triggered. The crew realizes they're experiencing hallucinations based on their imaginations. They struggle to contain the subspace anomaly causing these hallucinations and prevent it from expanding and destroying the station. And then they figure out how the anomaly originated, including the fact that there was aliens behind it, and find a solution before it's too late. In the end, the crew is able to contain and resolve the anomaly, and Odo warns everyone to stop using their imaginations in the future. The end.
I'm not saying it wasn't aliens, but it was aliens.
It was, exactly. It's always aliens, especially in Star Trek. So, Father Corey, your overall impression of this one?
Other than creepy Bashir, I like this one. This mm-hmm. you know, this is one, it's a rare first season episode that was pretty decent. I like the idea that Starfleet is the one being observed instead of Starfleet doing the observing. So, it was interesting, the different characters and everything that they pulled out to show the different, you know, kind of help develop the main cast as well. It was kind of a development episode mm-hmm. for them as well. So I kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah. I like it too. It's one of the better season one episodes. And I agree. Stalker Bashir is still annoying to me. Like, he is, it's too creepy. I'm so glad they stopped doing this, because mm-hmm. it was obnoxious. It's even back in 1990, whatever, this was still creepy. Like, today it's sort of over the top. Like, this would be a, you know, hashtag Me Too thing. But back then, even then, it was like, dude, like, oh, like a little too strong, like dial it back a notch.
And I know they did it to try, you know, show that he's this young, inexperienced, you know, full of vim and vigor.
Right.
Officer, and in fact, but
Dax at one point says to, like, she goes to the you know, the command deck, and Sisko says, how is our young doctor? And she says, young. Because, of course, she's Dax. She's over 300 years old. But yeah.
Well, and she even says at one point, I was a young man once too.
Right, right. And she takes it with pretty, you know, with aplomb. She doesn't get offended by him or anything, but she's almost
amused by alternate sexy Dax.
Right, right. Yeah, that whole thing. We'll get into the various hallucinations they have and or don't have in some cases. So we do start with this Odo Quark exchange in Quark's bar, where Odo declares imagination is a waste of time. Too many people dream of places they'll never go, wish for things they'll never have, instead of paying adequate attention to their real lives. And I'm thinking, he's not wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, imagination is good, But, you know, I see a lot of people spending a lot of their time imagining a better life, a life, you know, the Instagram life, shall we say, or the mm-hmm. YouTube life, instead of paying attention to the life that they have in front of them that could be just as fulfilling.
Well, you know, obviously we enjoy science fiction television, you know, we enjoy, mm-hmm. you know, video games and these things that can take us out of the real world for, you know, an hour or, you know, few minutes at a time or whatever.
Yeah.
But there are people that's a real concern, that they get so either they don't want to face their real world, or they prefer what they see in the video game or what they see in Star Trek or something like that, that they get lost in it. And that is a real problem, mm-hmm. that they allow that imagination to be more important to them than their family, their friends, their career, whatever it might be, you know, that they're trying to avoid.
They start to lose their own identity. They start thinking of themselves as, you know, some extreme cases, I'm a dog or you know, or a dragonkin is a thing I've seen, you know, like no, like, let's come back to be a little more grounded in the world around us.
Exactly.
I see it sometimes where people, they get so caught up in celebrity culture, they start to think that, you know, I'm only interested romantically in, you know, celebrity quality people. You know, I'm not interested in the regular person that I meet. I'm only in like, but you're not a celebrity. You're not, you know, that person.
You're not a celebrity, like, and you definitely don't have the looks for it. So
I was not going to say that, but yeah, that's kind of what I meant.
I'll say it. Yeah, and that's both guys and gals, by the way. Yeah. That's definitely not sexist.
Yeah, and that's the thing is people are, you know, too often live in a fantasy world, and that there's a corrective in this story to that mindset. It's like, you know, don't like Bashir's especially. Careful of living too much in a fantasy world and creating these ephemeral ideas that are only in your head of the way things should be or could be.
Right.
You know, and we can live in the world you have.
And we can work both ways with that too, is where, you know, something happens that upsets you that, you know, oh, you know, and you're running through your mind for the next month of, oh, if I would have thought faster, I would have, or if they say anything to me, I'm going to punch them out, or, you know.
Right. Right.
Oh, and know, we can work both ways. And you start harboring grudges because of your imaginary taking this little slight and blowing it out of proportion.
Right. Or imagining that a thing that someone said that was to them innocuous, they don't mean anything by it. You imagine that it was meant as a cutting remark or something to harm you. Yeah. And our imagination gets away from us. So I'm not with Odo in the sense of we should not have stories or imaginary play or anything like that. But I am with him where we got to keep our imaginations at least under control. And that's good. So this is also a story where we get the introduction of the baseball hall of programs, because Quark mentions it to Odo that young Mr. Sisko has been going into the holosuites. That's what the word. At which apparently up to this point were only used for more prurient purposes, shall we say, in a nice way, you know, because it's Quark's. Because Odo is sort of scandalized by Jake going in there, and it's like, no, he's doing this holo program of something called baseball. And they, you know, so you get these two aliens discussing human sports, which is kind of funny. Yeah.
Well, I love that whole scene where Quark's like, I'm going into family entertainment. I'm going to rent like the next suite over so I could put in more hollow suites and, you know, and run them all off one server and the whole works.
And you know, sell souvenirs that are pointless. And I'm like, what he wants is a Ferengi Disney World.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought that was funny.
And by the way, he does get that in Lord X.
That's right. He does. Yeah.
Because he gets the Quark's Bar gift shop.
That's right. That's funny. That's true. So, and then we go to our first instance of these hallucinations showing up, which is O'Brien and his family. Now, this is, again, one of the things that makes DS9 different from all the other Star Trek series is the families and that family connection. So you get, you know, Jake and Ben Sisko, but you get Miles and Keiko and Molly.
Yep.
And I really, you know, enjoy seeing Miles as dad. I mean, it was like, it really took me back to when my kids were that age and reading the bedtime stories. Yeah. And I guess Colm Meaney does really good voices with the impressions of the characters. So I thought that was really good.
That had to be a lot of fun. And it's interesting because, of course, that was one of the criticisms of the Enterprise D in TNG, mm-hmm. is that it was a ship with kids and family. And you see that there's a couple episodes where that plays in.
Yeah.
But it's not to this level where the family is just as much important part of the character as the character themselves.
Right.
You would not have Ben Sisko without Jake. You would not have Chief O'Brien without Molly and Keiko.
Yes. And you didn't see normal family interactions like you do on DS9. You know, mm-hmm. you didn't see Wesley and Beverly sitting down to dinner or talking about school and these normal ways you do here. All that was sort of ancillary, whereas it's really fundamental to DS9. I feel like the writers and producers here really wanted to make that central to this show. So I really like that.
Actually, you mentioned Beverly and Wesley. I seem to recall, like, when he first comes back from the academy, she tries to have that kind of conversation. How are things going at the academy? And he's like, I'm going to go with my friends. I'll see you later. Right. And they just blow it off. I mean, there's just none of it.
Jerk teenager.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have Rumpelstiltskin showing up in Molly's quarters. I saw this was very interesting. I was looking at the Memory Alpha wiki, and they said originally the character was written as a leprechaun, and Colm Meaney, he objected strenuously. Because it's as an offensive Irish stereotype, and they had to rewrite the story to change it from leprechaun to Rumpelstiltskin, which I think was successful. I think it's better that way anyway.
Although I was disappointed Rumpelstiltskin wasn't Robert Carlyle, who of course plays Rumpelstiltskin in Once Upon a Time. But
but too tall, I think, is the problem. Yep.
Yeah. No, obviously that's much later after he played that role. But yeah, that was well done because he was obviously the troublesome imp.
Yes. Yeah. And there was a moment where, you know, when in the story you say Rumpelstiltskin and it harms him and he goes away. And he says it to him, Rumpelstiltskin. And he's like, oh. Would you think that was going to work on me? No.
Yeah. I just hate hearing it.
And then the next one is Jake has this baseball player from our future, called Buck Bakai. Not too far distant
future, but.
Yep. Yep. Who plays for the London Kings. So apparently the Major League Baseball expands globally, follows Jake home from the holosuite. Cause we're like a dog following you home. That would have been weird. Like stepping out of the holosuite and having the character follow you, which we saw in TNG with Moriarty following the captain out.
But that was the holosuite within a holosuite.
Yes. The fake out.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. They say that the last World Series was 2042.
Right.
So only less than 20 years from now, supposedly, at least in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, that's right. In the Star Trek universe. Right. I forgot that. I for some reason, I thought 2142, but no, 2042. No, and
he started playing in the 20 teens.
Right. Right. And like the greatest player ever. And which is not surprising given how many, cause I think he's Japanese, right? Bakai? I don't know what kind of what nationality this, but we have so many great Japanese players playing for the Major League Baseball now that wouldn't be surprising to have the greatest player come from Japan.
Exactly. By the way, he was played by Keon Young, who was voiced Commander Sato in Rebels, Star Wars Rebels.
Oh, that's why he's so familiar. Okay.
And he's also done a bunch of voices on Avatar, the animated Avatar The Last Airbender. Actually, I have to say that now because got the live action one now too.
Right. Now he's Korean, so maybe Buck Bakai is supposed to be Korean, which would be interesting. Yeah. But he has an American accent, so he's probably American born or something like that. It's interesting. You know, he says, what was it like the last World Series? There was only 30 people in the stands or something like that.
300.
And Sisko says 301 because he was there in the holo suite watching. And it is interesting to think about that, you know, things do change. Things go out of fashion. I can imagine, as Sisko says, it's a slower game. You know, people had a faster paced life. Although in in the Star Trek universe, in Star Trek history, that was around the time of the big war that destroyed everything. And
this would have been the war because it was 2060s was the 2063 was the first contact.
Zefram Cochrane? Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, because that was the 100 years from it was 100 years after the start of Star Trek.
Right.
You know, they
said so. Yeah, it would have been 2063 then. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that would have been around the time of the war and the bad things happening in the world. So they don't say it in this, but yeah, that would be part of that.
This also carries over to the rest of the series, because the baseball that Buck Bukai throws him remains on Sisko's desk. This is the same baseball that you see Goldacott playing with. You're seeing when, as the sign of Sisko saying, "I'm coming back later."
It's interesting then, because then these are real things. Like the people that they see, Buck Bukai, Rumpelstiltskin, the fake Jadzia, are all real, physical. They persist. They're not being kept in place by alien thought. They have substance that persists.
They're non-corporeal. The way the wiki kind of explains it, they're non-corporeal aliens who take on corporeal form.
But they're not just like ephemeral. Like they, because that ball sticks around long after the various creatures, the various aliens are gone. So it's kind of interesting. So I could see Sisko being a baseball fan, kind of excited. I've got this ball that Buck Bukai gave me, not the real one, but you know, was kind of.
Exactly.
If I got a Tom Brady football, you know, from a alien pretending to be Tom Brady, I'd probably keep it.
I'm sure.
and then we get Bashir's fantasy. Bashir is sleeping in his uniform without a blanket or sheets or anything. I find it very weird on DS9 how often people are sort of sleeping on these weird Cardassian beds without sheets or blankets. It's very hot.
Beds in the TNG, beds in Star Trek in general are just strange. I mean, even going back to the original series, at least in the original series, they look like actual beds instead of just a piece of foam mattress put on foam mattress put on some wood, you know, on a platform.
Yeah,
it's just beds in Star Trek are weird.
Although the episode we talked about last time, Angel One, where it's Picard was in bed sick, he actually had sheets and you know pajamas, so that was just that.
But they always had these little tiny pillows and things like that. I mean,
but Bashir is in his uniform and he gets his silly airheaded Jadzia submissive fantasy girl. Uncomfortable. I'm sorry. It's very uncomfortable to watch that.
Well, it was, and at least you know, you put up a little bit of a fight, and then she goes, "Why are you resisting me?" And he goes, "Why am I resisting you?" And it's just like, "Oh, wrong."
Yeah, it was kind of funny, but yes, because you know it's wrong, Bashir. That's why. That's why it's wrong, Julian.
Yep.
It is interesting how in the story how quickly they figure out that these fantasy figures are coming out of their imaginations. That's not drawn out, and so then the question very quickly turns to where are they coming from, and then discovering it's this subspace anomaly that, you know, we get the ticking clock because it's growing, and because we know that a similar one destroyed a star system that the Vulcans discovered.
Or they think it's coming from the anomaly.
Right.
It turns out the anomaly is Jadzia's
fantasy. Yeah, that's right. That's right. We do get some kind of subspace distortion, by the way. So Voyager wasn't the only one doing that.
It just wasn't often in DS9, that's for sure.
Right. Another one that we see is a fantasy or hallucination is, in reality, there were live emus on the set. They called them something else, some other alien creature.
Yeah, some bird from some planet somewhere, but they're emus. And that was so much fun watching Odo and his security team trying to deal with them.
I don't know. You got to be careful of those emus. You know that there was the Great Emu War in Australia where the Australian army lost to the emus.
Yeah, the emus won.
Emus are bad news, folks. That's
we have
story.
To get the Catholics of Oz to tell us about that story. Yes. If it's not too much of a painful memory.
Look it up on Wikipedia, folks. The emus won the Great Emu War. Odo's on the promenade yelling to everyone, as I mentioned in the recap, would please everyone refrain from using your imaginations.
Yeah.
Like, don't think of pink elephants, whatever you do. That would have been funny.
Meanwhile, Quark definitely got his imagination. Two very beautiful, scantily dressed women.
I did see where Armin Shimerman said this was one of his favorite episodes. I don't blame him. He says they were very nice young ladies. They were very pleasant. Very beautiful, too. there was that. And then, although it was funny that he was very distracted until Odo pointed out that everyone was winning at Dabo, and suddenly losing money became much more important than the beautiful young women. Oh, man. So we get, it is interesting how little we get about the aliens. They're sort of, like, as you mentioned, they're sort of explorers. They're trying to, like, learn more about humans, and this is how they do it. Our reaction to their fantasy figures, the hallucinations, are they find it to be odd, especially how Julian rejects the fake Jadzia and how Sisko kind of holds the fake Buck Bakai at arm's length a little bit. Although it's interesting, Sisko doesn't, like, some characters would say, no, you're not real and I refuse to believe you. Whereas Sisko kind of is warm towards him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he knows he's not real, it's kind of an interesting difference in character.
Well, I suppose it have to do with, if nothing else, just the idea of the holodeck and or holosuites and being able to see these characters, play and act, not just like reading a book or watching a TV show, but be there and interact with them.
Yeah.
And so, and at first, Sisko was thinking, okay, how did this hollow character come out of the hollow suite? Because it felt, like you said, it followed Jake home.
Right.
Or he followed Jake home. But then I think, too, Sisko realized that this character had more knowledge and information than the real Buck Bakai would have.
Right.
So it seemed like he knew that there was something deeper there than just a figment of his imagination.
Right. I mean, this character knew Ben. He knew, he called him by name. Ben, what's going on?
Yeah, and Sisko was the first to point out, hey, these are real things. They're figments of our imagination, but they're real. There's something real to them.
Right, right. Kira gets a hallucination of a fireball coming down the hallway at her. That's nice. Poor thing.
Well, with a guy on fire running at her.
Oh, yeah. That was quite dramatic. They had to get a stuntman to get lit on fire for that one. That was kind of wild.
You could kind of see the stunt suit, though, the fire suit.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, but it still looked pretty good.
And then Odo does have an imagination because he imagined Quark in his cell.
No imagination.
That was good. And then Jake gets a sort of a temptation in the desert moment where he's in the quarters and he needs to do his homework. And Buck is trying to convince him to go, let's go to this holosuite and shag some flies, and just throw the ball around a little bit. And Jake's like, no, my dad would kill me. I have to do my homework. And that's one of the things that sort of confounds the aliens. It's like, what? We're trying to give them everything they want and they don't want it. Why? And so they're learning about humanity, how we can resist temptation to do what we need to do. We can, always.
And you even have an imaginary Sisko show up and start saying, start encouraging, say you will, do your homework. And he's, I've got all these excuses why I haven't done it yet. But it wasn't Sisko. It was the imagination.
Yes, that's true. So, very interesting. There is one moment near the end where it's Rumpelstiltskin's in ops with O'Brien and he makes Keiko and Molly appear. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure whether they were the real Keiko and Molly or hallucination ones because they don't go away and they act like the real Keiko and Molly would. and he acts toward them like they're real. So what did you think? Were they real?
I think they implied that they were real, because at the end, you know, Sisko tells O'Brien, take them home. And right. They walk off screen together.
Right. Exactly.
So these aliens apparently had the ability to transport things as well, as part of their ability to generate material things.
Right. I think so.
That's the way I took it, again, that this wasn't just figment of imagination, but this actually was them being transported up to ops.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. It was a different power ability than we'd seen before. And right. If anything, I mean, that they left that confusing, and that's a little bit of flaw in the writing, I suppose. But
pretty minor doing that, one, though.
Yeah, it's a minor flaw. But this is where Sisko figures out the solution, which is everything is the product of a wish, or at least an expectation. And as more people believe that it exists, the anomaly, this disruption, its size increases. So Sisko orders O'Brien to lower the shields as a way of saying, I don't believe it exists. And he orders everyone not to believe that there's a subspace disruption outside the station. And O'Brien complies, which is a big deal, because his family's right there. If Sisko's wrong, his family dies. So it's interesting to see that.
And they kind of threw a hint in early when they did the little, you know, photon torpedo with whatever techno babble of the week.
Yeah.
Where at some point it's saying there's nothing on the sensors. It's not picking up anything. And then all of a sudden it does.
Right. Yes. So, yeah, that's true. That is a hint that it wasn't real at all to begin with. It's sort of the power of belief, you know, the Tinkerbell, you know, clap your hands and say, I believe. I mean, it's a little bit of that, except the opposite, which is I don't believe that this thing exists. Some people have theorized this is an anti-faith story, like to stop believing in. I don't think of it that way. I think it's more of just an exploration of our imagination and our ability to separate what's real from what's not real.
And the creating power of imagination. Yes, we can't imagine a baseball into an existence, but we, in our minds, we can imagine read about a game and imagine what happened, or, you know, the creative, you know, the imaginations that created things like Star Trek. You know, that's how we create with our imaginations. It's not just, it's not something we can make things material, but it takes our hands to do it. We can't just will it into an existence.
Right. Not like God, ex nihilo.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
It's funny when you think about that, like, because in some sense that the very show that is they're creating is an act of the imagination that they're all engaged in, making it real. So the whole the phrase, the title, "If Wishes Were Horses," comes from a phrase. I'm not sure where the phrase itself comes from, but if wishes were horses, then dreamers would ride. I'm not sure where that comes from, actually. But it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's this phrase I'd never heard before.
Oh, really? No, I've heard that a lot. If wishes were horses and dreamers would ride, but I don't know where that comes from. Anyway, any other notes on this one, Father Corey?
Nope.
Very good. Then let's get to our feedback. This comes from our discussion of the original series episode, A Taste of Armageddon. John Sevard writes on YouTube, "Here's a secret about this episode. Herman Woke is a very well-known author, Pulitzer Prize-winning, by the way, but one of his novels, a short one written in 1949 but only published in 1956, is not at all well-known. While the plot is different, the novel is intended as an anti-war statement. It uses the same unusual premise as this episode." So I went back in looking, and actually it was hard to find. It was actually not in his general list of Herman Welk's books, which included like the Caine Mutiny and other great stories. But this one is called, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, the Lomocome Papers, L-O-M-O-K-O-M-E papers. It's a sci-fi novel. It's the only science fiction novel that Woke wrote, and it's sort of the diary of or a recounting of a naval lieutenant's expedition to the moon and the people he encounters there. Now, obviously, written in 1949, so before, you know, moon landings, right, and when people still thought there might be aliens on the moon, that sort of thing. But apparently part of it included this this same sort of idea where you had people who had to march into execution chambers as a sort of bloodless way of conducting war.
Virtual warfare, we would call it today.
Right. So very interesting. So thank you, John, for pointing that out. That might be worthwhile. It's not very long, so you know, maybe someone may be interested in reading this sort of thing and letting us know what they think. Excellent. So as we move on, we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Star Trek, including Vincent D., Paul L., Ryan O., Adika L., and Tom V. Their generous tax-deductible donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Star Trek and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And we'd also like to thank Victor Lambs, who edited this episode. So that's it from us. We'd love to know what you thought of If Wishes Were Horses. You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/trek, our Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, send an email to trek@sqpn.com, or visit our Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord, or leave a comment on our YouTube channel where you can watch the Secrets of Star Trek. And you can find that at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. We'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the Voyager episode, Revulsion. Until then, Father Corey Stika, thank you for joining me and sharing the secrets of Star Trek.
Thank you, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to the Secrets of Star Trek on StarQuest. And remember, I'm going to have to ask you all to please refrain from using your imaginations.